open your Bibles with me at Psalm number 60, which we will try to understand for our good and for our blessing. Speaking from my own personal experience, going back quite a number of years, granted, I make the statement that students training for the ministry can at times be rather stupid and irreverent, making fun of things which should be taken seriously. And I can well remember in a class at Christ College, Divinity College in Aberdeen, joking about Psalm number 60 and having great fun amongst ourselves as we try to imagine the reaction that there would be from a congregation if some Sunday morning we said at the appropriate point, "My text this morning is Psalm number 60, verse 8. Moab is my washpot, over Edom have I cast out my shoe." We were assuming, of course, that some congregation somewhere would have either the wisdom or the folly of calling us to be ministers. But it is stupid to concentrate on a verse like that and on language like that and references like that, which I'm quite sure the people at that time would understand perfectly well, just as we understand in our own context various phrases that we use. For example, we sometimes speak about a hung parliament. Now, there are those from a different culture who might think that that refers to all the members of parliament being hung, which mightn't be a bad idea. In our own culture here in the city of Glasgow, we speak about the Glasgow Fair holidays, although there isn't a Glasgow Fair anymore, but we know what it means. And we use phrases like, "Well, I wash my hands of the whole thing," but it doesn't mean that we actually wash our hands. And it's exactly the same with this kind of verse here, referring to Moab and to Edom. "Oh," says God, they are totally irrelevant. They are scarcely worth a moment's consideration. And they are referred to in terms of the wash basin. And that was the lowest slave in the house had to take the basin of water and wash people's feet. And when the master of the house came home and took off his shoes, he would just throw them at a slave for the slave to... That's what this verse is all about. God is saying these presumptuous, pompous nations, they are nothing. They are quite irrelevant. And they are dismissed. They are devalued. And they are shown to be altogether pathetic and insignificant in face of the sure purposes of God. I don't know, I forgot to check up. Maybe Spurgeon, the great preacher of Victorian times, preached on this psalm, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if he preached on that particular verse. And if he did, the theme of his sermon would certainly be that God puts evil in its place. And I find that an immensely comforting thought. But we come to this psalm, which is really important. The heading of the psalm points out, as I indicated to you, that it is for instruction. It is for teaching. And we have to ask, well, if that's the case, what is being taught in this psalm? Well, I think it is clear from verses 1, 2, and 3 of the psalm that David the king and his people and his whole cause had gone through a rather shattering experience. In the work of God, in which they had rejoiced in God's blessing, they suffered, as it were, out of the blue, a tremendous reverse. Everything went wrong. They were shattered. They didn't quite know what to make of it. They had gone through this experience, and they were aware of the fact that God had been in this experience. If you like, God had allowed this to happen. And by this happening, God had shaken them. And they really were shaken. And so we've got to ask the question, what are the dangers? What is the greatest danger in Christian life and service that might possibly lead us? Not so much personally, but as a work, into a situation like that, which is manifestly a situation of God's rebuke. What is the greatest danger in Christian life and service? Well, to my mind, it is not the danger of falling into gross moral wrong, although that can happen to some of even the choicest saints, and it happened to David himself shortly after this situation, in his terrible sin in which he murdered a man and stole his wife. And when I speak like that, I find it necessary to say to myself and to say to you the words of that Paul spoke in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12, "Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall." Don't ever assume or presume that you are past that kind of danger. The greatest danger is not falling into gross moral wrong, nor is the greatest danger a desire for popularity and for recognition, although that is one of the main dangers of every person called to be a preacher of the gospel. And this craving for recognition and for praise and popularity is spoken of by our Lord Jesus Christ in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6. "Beware of practicing your piety before men in order to be seen by them." Oh, be careful lest you fall into the snare of adopting such an attitude and speaking in such a way and using the kind of language that is hopefully calculated to make people say, "Oh, isn't he spiritual?" In the third epistle of John, written by that altogether lovely man, John, he warned some Christians about a man in the congregation called Diotrephes, who loved to have the preeminence. But that's not the greatest danger either, nor is the greatest danger pride, self-congratulation. And that's a terrible snare. Especially if God blesses you in your service. There are some people, history testifies to this, who have made shipwreck of their Christian lives because on one occasion, when they spoke on some occasion or at some meeting, it pleased God to bring someone to faith in Jesus Christ. And they thought, "Oh, God used my preaching to convert us all." And this has become such a focus of their whole Christian life that from that point onwards, they have been of no use to God. Oh, it is a danger, the danger of self-congratulation. And we need to remember Paul's words to the Corinthians. I'm reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 4 at verse 6. "I have applied all this," says Paul, "to myself and Apollos for your benefit, brethren, that you may learn by us not to go beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up in favor of one against another. For who sees anything different in you? What have you that you did not receive as a gift from God? If then you received it, why do you boast as if it were not a gift? I've said it before, I say it again, and I often say it to myself, the conversions that I'm happiest about are the ones that I really know nothing about. It's God's doing. It's always God's doing. Did we quote last evening at the Bible study, Paul may plant and Apollos water, but it is God who gives the increase. Well, you say, preacher, what is the greatest danger that faces us? Well, I believe from this psalm, we are told that the greatest danger is spiritual complacency. Now, I agree that there is an element, a real element of spiritual pride in that. What do we mean by spiritual complacency? Something like this. Our attitude is, well, I've been a Christian a long time now, and I've sat under good biblical ministry a long time, and I've learned a lot about the Bible. I feel I've grown quite a bit. Spiritually now, I'm not a novice. I'm stable. I suppose I'm getting into the category of being one of the senior or more long-standing Christians involved in the work. And I feel now that I've learned, and I'm able to cope with whatever comes. But do you not see that there is an assumption there? An assumption that because God has been with you in the past and blessed you in your service in the past up until now, you assume that it will always be so. That's spiritual complacency. Let me remind many of you who are not able to be at the prayer meeting that very seldom does a Saturday go past without there being expressed in prayer, yes, by the minister or by the elders or by any taking part in prayer, expressed the prayer that God will be pleased to be with us on the coming day. We don't assume that he will be here. We're not suggesting that he's fickle and that he changes and sometimes he's here and sometimes he's not. But we do not want to presume upon God. And we ask him, we beseech him, that inasmuch as he has been pleased to be with us on previous Sunday, so he'll be with us again. We prayed before the service tonight, before we came into church, that as God had been with us this morning to bless us, so please would he be with us tonight. There is a tremendous danger in spiritual complacency. One of the classic examples of that, of course, is the story of Samuel in the book of Judges, chapter 16. Now, Samuel was a great character, humanly speaking, and an even greater character, spiritually speaking, because God, the Lord, had laid hold upon him for service, and he was a man who had been greatly used by God, but he became complacent. He started to give himself liberties that he had no right to give himself in the practical business of daily living and moral rectitude. And there came a time when he faced great danger, and he said, I will arise, I will go out as I've done before, and I'll fight the battles of the Lord. And he did not know that God was no longer with him. His spiritual complacency had cost him the presence of God and the unction of God upon his life and service. Another example is from the beginning of the book of Joshua. Remember, they crossed the Jordan, the command of God, and in obedience to the command of God, they circled the city of Jericho, and the walls of Jericho came tumbling down, and they conquered. Oh, it was great. Oh, let's go on to the next stage. And on they went to the next stage. But we are told in Scripture, it's in Joshua chapter 7, verse 1, but the children of Israel broke faith with God. It was nothing very obvious. Very few people knew about it. It was secret sin. And when they came to the city of Ai, oh well, they've conquered Jericho, let's do it again. And they were put to flight. Like Samson, they were guilty of spiritual complacency. They presumed upon God. Oh, you say, we don't think we would do that. Put it in different language. They took God for granted. Yes, that comes home, doesn't it? But taking God for granted is a contradiction of faith and obedience. And if this spiritual complacency is left to develop and to establish itself, then it would undermine the whole future of the work of God. And so God shook David. Oh, he was taking it all in his stride. Hadn't God blessed him? Hadn't God given him significant victories? Didn't God recognize the authenticity of his faith and his service? But he was taking it for granted. He was assuming. He was presuming. There was spiritual complacency, and God shook David, and God shook Israel. God shook the work of God with defeat and with failure. Now, we've got to be careful here, because we mustn't assume that every failure has to be interpreted in terms of God's rebuke. And we're talking here, as we indicated earlier, not so much on a personal level, but in relation to the work of God. And so in relation to the work of God, we remind ourselves that the situation is that of David's campaign. As God's man fighting the battles of the Lord. And remember earlier on, we read on one Sunday evening from the Old Testament scriptures how the people rejoiced and they said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. I think David was aware of that. And he began to feel that he was better than others. He was a success. So was his leadership. And so was his work. Because under the leadership, the kingship of David, the whole kingdom was being subdued and was being forged into a nation that would be the instrument of God for generations to come. If, as I indicated, 2 Samuel chapter 8, and these other chapters describe the situation. David made a name for himself. It says that in the chapter. David reigned and David administered justice. And that's in the chapter, 2 Samuel chapter 8. But David, we are told in that same chapter, 2 Samuel chapter 8, David also made enemies. And Derek Kidner in his commentary on the psalm says that one thing that this psalm and the background of it teaches us or reminds us is this. It reminds us of the resilience of David's neighbors. And that is a reminder to us that we, if we are to be engaged in fighting God's battles, then just as with David's experience, so it will be with ours, that peoples and powers and interests will unite together to fight against the work of God. And I've no doubt at all that in our own day and generation, and I keep close watch in the various realms of what we call the media, and there is a coming together, very subtly, of anti-Christ and anti-Christian and anti-gospel and anti-evangelical influences. And this is how it was with David. I was quite disturbed to realize that in 2 Samuel chapters 8, 9 and 10, I was reading all about David's victories. Yes, there were reverses, but there was repentance and restoration and victories. 2 Samuel chapters 8, 9 and 10, victories, successes, advances. Then 2 Samuel chapter 11, David's great fall. The story of Uriah and Bathsheba. And it happened because of spiritual complacency. He was just so sure that he was spiritually secure that he forgot to watch and pray lest he entered into temptation. I've said it before, I say it again. The wise words of the Salvation Army officer: sometimes we have temptation, but no opportunity. Sometimes we have opportunity, but no temptation. But God help us if we have temptation and opportunity at the same time. I nearly said young people, I better include older people as well. Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. Guard your soul lest this dread infliction or dead disease inflicts you of spiritual complacency. The lesson, as I say in this psalm, is not individual. It has to do with the nation. It has to do with the work of God. Things were going well. I can imagine, in a sense, though the words were not yet spirit-given in a strict sense, I can imagine David and his companions saying, "If God be for us, who can be against us?" But while the victories were being won in the north of the nation, and they were rejoicing in these victories, in the south, Edom attacked, launched its powers against the work of God and against the people of God, and ravaged them both. And the enemy won a great victory, even though it was a temporary victory. It shook David and his kingdom, and it brought David and his people to their senses. I can remember being deeply moved by a very buoyant character of a minister. One of these very bouncy, bounding kind of characters. Sometimes used to envy him, his enthusiasm and his buoyancy. And how he testified at our minister's conference on one occasion, that God had to put him flat on his back in hospital. And God said, "Now, will you listen to me? I honor the man for speaking like that amongst his fellow ministers." This is what happened to David. David had become complacent. He was sound in doctrine. Yes, he stood firm. Yes, he had his priorities right. Yes, the hand of God was upon him. But he became complacent. And that complacency on the part of the leader spread to the people and to the work. until God had no option but to shake them to the core to bring them to their senses. And so in the first four verses of the psalm, we are told of disaster at the hand of God. Oh God, thou hast rejected us, broken our defenses. Thou hast been angry, oh restore us. Thou hast made the land to quake, thou hast rent it open, oh repair its breaches, for it taught. Thou, oh, says David, this God, this is your doing. This is not an accident. This is not just a failure in military communication between the various sections of the army. This is God's doing. And David was quite clear that it was God's doing. And David became very, very clear that what God had done was a rebuke to his self-confidence. And there is a possibility, and I can't be too sure about this, there is a possibility that David and his men in their service for God had simply rushed on in their own success, carried along by their own enthusiasm. But that doesn't necessarily lead you in the will of God. You can be very enthusiastic about all that you're thinking and all that you're planning to do. It may not be God's will. And if it's not, you're heading for disaster. And it could be here, I believe it was here, that a succession of victories and many, many indications of God's blessing upon their lives and upon the work caused them just to career on. Carried along by their own impetus. And when that happens, you see, they and we reach the stage that we're too busy to listen to God. And David realized it must have been an awful shock to him. I think ministers can understand this. David realized that what he had worked for at great cost over many years was in danger of being demolished completely. And when we come to verse 4, thou hast set up a banner for those who fear thee to rally to it from the bow. As I said, I don't know if this is God setting up a banner for the people to gather to in order to retreat completely from the field of battle, or whether it was God setting up a banner to rally the remnant of faith who were still willing and able to listen to what God was saying so that they might find hope again for the future. And so verses 1 to 4, disaster at the hand of God. You know, God takes us seriously. He wants us to be right. He wants us to be usable. And when God sees that for various reasons, often spiritual complacency, that we are in danger of not only hindering but demolishing our usefulness, God simply says, I can't let them do that. And he shakes us to our very foundations. Then when we go on to verses 5 to 8, we have what I seem to think or seem to find is assurance in God. I love that word. I've got it underlined in red biro in my Bible. That thy beloved. David recognizes, you see, that he is loved by God. And this is something we forget to remind ourselves about. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us. We read it this morning as we gather at the Lord's table. God commended his love toward us, in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. And so David, as it were, speaks to God and seeks and finds assurance in God. And he says, that thy beloved may be delivered, give victory by thy right hand. And that's, oh God, says David, we're in a real mess and we deserve to be. And only you can get us out of it. It is as if David is saying, oh God, I know you love me, but if I'm going to have a future in your service, you'll have to rescue me and set me right. If you look back to the very first verse of the psalm, David says, oh God, thou hast rejected us. In verse 5 he says, but oh God, you still love us. And it's amazing really to think that once given God's love, God never withdraws that love. No matter how deeply he's grieved with us, no matter how deeply his heart is hurt by our attitude, no matter how much he is disappointed with us, his love remains. I was reading late afternoon today in the prophecy of Micah chapter 6. Don't think we take time to read it. It's where God is speaking to his people and he says, oh my people, what have I done? Wherein have I failed you that you treat me as if I was nothing? There was in their hearts, you see, no response to the love with which God had loved them. Could God be saying that to any of us tonight? Saying to us, my dear child, I've loved you, and I've blessed you, and I've cared for you, but I don't seem to matter to you anymore. Have I failed you? That you're so reluctant to give me of the spontaneity of your love and the commitment of your service? Makes me think of that verse that we studied on Sunday evenings in the book of Revelation, where God said to a certain church, oh, I have this against you. You have left the love that you had at the first. Oh, there are so many references. I don't know that I really want to read them all. This is what I've been reading in Deuteronomy chapter 32 at verse 9. The Lord's portion is his people. In a sense, it's, what does God get out of all his marvelous grace and redemption? He gets you and me. So we'd say in Aberdeen, it's a hearty bargain. The Lord's portion is his people. This is what God gets. You and me. Jacob, his allotted heritage. He found him in a desert land, in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him, he cared for him, he kept him as the apple of his eye, like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, touching them, bearing them on its pinions. Oh, how often has God, when you've really felt you are coming a cropper, how often has God just swooped, as it were, under you in his grace and kept you and lifted you up again? The Lord alone did lead him, and there was no foreign god with him. He made him ride in the high places of the earth. He ate the produce of the field. He made him suck honey out of the rock and oil out of the flint. Says the book of Deuteronomy, how God blessed his people. And in a sense, here in our psalm, in these verses 5, 6, 7, and 8, David is beginning to remember this. Oh, God has done so much for them. And he's recalling all that God has done. And I think David and the people begin to cry to God, Oh, give us victory. God, deliver us. Oh, God, take us back again. And I wonder if there are folk who should be saying that here in church tonight, knowing that you haven't walked with God as once you did, knowing you haven't loved him as once you did, knowing that you haven't served him, knowing that you've wandered. Oh God, take me back. I had to turn up my concordance to find the reference, and I'd realized I was looking for it in all the wrong places. And I eventually found it in Psalm 85, verse 5. Wilt thou be angry with us forever? Wilt thou not revive us again, that thy people may rejoice in thee? Oh, that's what David's saying. Shaken. Oh, yes, and I can feel how shaken he was. Wilt thou not revive us again? Oh, you say, preacher, he's done it before. He's done it before with me. Not once, but more than once. Wilt thou not revive us again? Oh, dear God, says David, take us back and give our service back to us. In verses 6, 7, and 8, God speaks. And God is glad to speak because, you see, his people are now listening. And God speaks. And he really, and all the different territories of the promised land are really spoken about, although not all are named. And God said, look, all is mine. With exaltation, says God, my heart is full of enthusiasm. With exaltation I will divide up Shechem and portion out the vale of Succoth. Gilead is mine, and I'll give that to you. Manasseh is mine, I'll give that to you. Ephraim is my helmet, I'll give that to you. Judah is my scepter, and with Judah in my hand, I will further my purposes, and my kingly rule will come to pass. And David, I think, and his men are still aware of the evil powers that are against them. Oh, says God, all is mine, and I will give it to you. Where does it say in Corinthians, Paul speaking to the Christians, all things are yours, and you are Christ's, and Christ is God's. That's what Paul, that's what the psalmist is really on about here. God is saying that to them. What about the enemies, Moab and Edom and the Philistines? God shouts his victory over them. And Moab is reduced to the lowest servant to get the bowl of water and wash the victor's feet. And Edom, well, we said it earlier, the lowly, perhaps frightened, devalued slave, and the master comes home, takes off his shoes and casts them to the slave. No, God is not a tyrant. God is not a despiser of humanity. God's not a class distinction man. There is no distinctions with God. But he looks at evil. Puny, pathetic, irrelevant, displaced evil under the sovereign control of God to serve his purposes. God shouts his victory over evil, reduces evil to its rightful place a low, menial servant, because all is God's and victory is God's, and God gives the victory to his people, and they stand in that victory by the obedience of faith. And in the last few verses, 9, 10, 11, and 12, there is new hope. It's almost as if God was saying, yes, you look at the verses 9, 10, 11, and 12. It looks as if David the psalmist is saying, Lord, you gave us up. You left us to our own devices, and you are right to do so. We've been shaken. We've been humbled. We've learned our lesson. We no longer trust in ourselves. Take us back. Do you know these words in Isaiah chapter 54 at verse 7 where God says, for a brief moment I forsook you, but with great compassion I will gather you. In overflowing wrath for a moment I hid my face from you, but with everlasting love I will have compassion on you, says the Lord, your Redeemer. And when David says, oh God, will you take us back? The story of the prodigal again, and the father who runs, and the dirty, disheveled failure of a prodigal finds himself enveloped in forgiving, restoring love. Back to the family, back to the place of honor, and back to the place of service. And I would end this series of studies in the Psalms by saying this. If we see to it that we are right with God, there is no limit to our usefulness. But there is an enemy. And remember that when Jesus said, watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation, he didn't say that to his disciples at a time of their backsliding. He said it to them at one of the most significant points of their whole Christian life and service. Because you see, they stood on the threshold of the future. Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. But remember this, that God values you and his plans for your service so highly that if he thinks that they are to be hindered or demolished, he is prepared to shake you and me as he shook David to bring us back to himself and to go forward into service. I can think of no better hymn with which to finish this evening and to finish this series of services, and let alone to finish this sermon, than the hymn number 534. Soldiers of Christ, arise and put your armor on, strong in the strength which God supplies through his eternal Son. Hymn number 534.